This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
And welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on our climate emergency. You know, in recent shows, we have brought up versions of climate skepticism, people who think the climate crisis is just made up. We've talked about the influence of religion and how some, especially some evangelical Christians, believe God controls the climate. And if it warms, that must be God's will. Now, we haven't talked enough about those folks who say, well, the climate is always changing. Why is change a problem? How can you prove that it's changing in some sort of out of control way that's going to disrupt things more than they've been ever been disrupted, right? Now, that's crazy talk. It turns out climate scientists can prove that. And we have one of them with us today.
Wyatt Oswald is professor and director of faculty development at Emerson College. He is also a research associate at Harvard. And full disclosure, I should mention this past year, he was my senior colleague. Wyatt is an environmental scientist with a special interest in paleoecology, and we'll talk about what that is. He's published in Nature Sustainability and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and many other journals. Wyatt, welcome to the program.
Thank you both for having me on.
Why study past environments? It's the past. It's so long ago. So who cares?
Let me give you a couple of ways of thinking about this. So the first is an analogy, and this works well at Emerson, where I teach, where a lot of students come to study film. And the way I lay it out for them is to say, take your favorite movie and imagine that you're halfway through the movie and you press pause on a single frame. Now imagine that you're looking at that single frame of the film without having seen any of the movie up to that point. You would see some characters, you'd see them in a particular context, but you really wouldn't have much sense of what's going on. Like, what's been the story up to that point? What are the relationships among the people? What is this setting all about? And perhaps even more importantly, you would have very little idea of where the story is going after that without any of the context up to that point. So in a way, the work that scientists like me do to reconstruct past environmental changes helps us have a sense of what the story has been like up to this point. And in turn, that also helps us think about where we're headed going forward. So just to give you a few more examples of the insights that we gain from looking to the past, we can go to periods of the past that are warmer than present. And we can use those to give us a sense of the consequences of our choices about how much CO2 goes into the atmosphere going forward and how warm the planet ends up being. We can also go back to past periods where climate has warmed abruptly or cooled abruptly. And we can see how the other components of the Earth system have changed, including, you know, how ecosystems have responded. And that's my particular interest, which is thinking about the way that ecosystems have responded to climate change, including abrupt climate change in the past, because that helps us think about the way that ecosystems will respond going forward. And then one last thing, to Elise's point about this sort of skepticism about sort of natural versus human caused climate change. If we go to the past and we can see how climate has changed due to the natural variability of the Earth system over different timescales, we can use that as context for taking a look at today and determining whether or not any of those factors that naturally cause climate change are operating in such a way that they would have created the warming of the last century. And in fact, they haven't.
So how do we do this research? How do we, since we can't time travel, how can we reconstruct climate's ecosystems from thousands of years ago? Because your research is interested in the very long term, right? And we were talking thousands of years.
Sure. And you're exactly right. Short of a time machine, the tools that we have at our disposal have to do with sort of reading natural archives that the planet has left behind for us. And those span hundreds, thousands, or in some cases, even millions of years. So just to give you a few examples of the types of natural archives that we can look to, ocean sediments build up over millions of years. And so if you collect a core of the mud at the bottom of the ocean, you, as you go down in the mud, you're going back in time. Similarly, glaciers in mountainous areas and the ice sheets on top of Greenland and Antarctica accumulate ice over time. And, you know, that ice is in the case of Greenland, literally 2 miles thick. So if you collect a core of the ice, as you go down in depth, you're going back in time. Depending on where you are, which of these ice sheets or glaciers, you can go back hundreds of thousands of years into the past. Tree rings are another way in which this is done. Trees don't live most trees don't live nearly as long as these other archives that we've been talking about. And in some cases, there are certain species that can go back several thousands of years into the past. And by measuring the width of the tree rings or measuring the chemistry of the wood, you can also get information about past climate. In my case, I take advantage of the fact that lakes and ponds fill up with mud over time, such that if you collect a core of the sediment at the bottom of the pond, you go back in time. So I've worked in Alaska. I've worked on these lake sediment records from the Pacific Northwest. And right now, most of my research is on these lake sediment records from New England.
Now, as you say, your research is New England. And what lessons do you think we can learn from the long-term history of New England ecosystems? What relevance does it have for present-day climate change?
Sure. So my own particular interest or specialty is identifying pollen grains that are preserved in the sediment. So once you collect a sediment core, we use radiocarbon dating to figure out how old the mud is at different depths. And then we analyze a bunch of different stuff that's preserved in the sediment. Little bits of charcoal tell you about past fires. The characteristics of the sediment itself, like sand layers, tell you about past climate. We can make chemical measurements that tell us about past temperature or precipitation. And then the pollen grains give us information about what the composition of the vegetation was like around that pond at different points in the past. So by making those kinds of analyses, we can see when climate changed in the past. We can see how abruptly it changed, or what the temperature and precipitation were like at different points in the past. And then we can see how the ecosystems responded. And by doing this over hundreds of different sites across Eastern North America, for example, we can see how different species have migrated over thousands of years. So the species that we commonly think of as Northeastern species, they spent the last ice age in the Southeastern United States. And then as climate warmed, and the ice sheets melted, those species migrated northwards over time. And we can put numbers on how fast they were able to move. The insight there is that they basically kept up with climate change. A question going forward, though, is human-caused climate change happening so fast that species will be able to keep up with their optimal climate, or will things really get out of whack as climate moves too quickly for species to sort of disperse themselves northward to keep up?
To clarify, can I clarify something? You mean when you say they keep up with climate, you mean as temperature changes, the species change where they live, they move around, maybe even quite dramatically at long distances, but it's easier for them to do that over long periods of time than it is to do that over short periods of time. The animals can migrate over long periods of time, but we're worried about whether they can migrate over short periods of time. Is that a fair summary, or is that a fair lesson from what you said?
Absolutely. And if you're thinking about plants, which are, rooted in place, literally, they're migrating by dispersing their seeds northwards, one generation at a time. There may be occasional instances of really long distance transport, but for the most part, that process of seed dispersal sort of creeps along pretty gradually. Over millennia, you can move species around and change their ranges in pretty serious ways. But the rapid nature of the warming that we're looking at over the next few decades is a different ballgame.
And that's a very interesting point, because what you started off with is talking about narratives to your students, right? And so you're talking about how important it is to know the story of the past, to get a sense of what's happening now. But you're also telling a story about what's going to happen in the future, are you not?
Oh, absolutely. I think we gain a huge amount of insight about the future changes in climate that we have ahead of us, as well as the future changes in ecosystems that I study and that we're talking about. You can also get insights into other aspects of the Earth system that we care about, like sea level rise, by going to the past, finding other times when climate has been warm, perhaps even warmer than it is right now, and seeing what sea level was like around the world. So I think we get huge value by trying to reconstruct the past as far as anticipating future changes goes.
You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio, and we're speaking with Wyatt Oswald, professor and director of faculty development at Emerson College, and we're talking to him about the long-term history of climate change. Professor Oswald is a climate scientist. You know, the climate skeptics, I think, are you're meeting them at the point of telling the story about the future, right? It seems to me that part of what they're skeptical about is that and that what is being contested is the story you all are telling going forward. So yeah, maybe all this happened in the past, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen going forward. Do you have any thoughts on how to talk to these skeptics, especially the kind who say that, you know, the climate is always changing, and how is this any different? Because they're basically saying, well, it's the past is the past, and it's not going to change that much.
Yeah, this is a key argument in the disinformation playbook, right? Which is that climate is always changing. Ice ages come and go. How do we know that the warming of the last century isn't just some sort of natural phenomenon? Scientists initially approached this as a legit question, right? Certainly it's the case that climate varies naturally over different timescales. And so how do we attribute recent global warming to human causes? Well, part of it comes from doing this kind of retrospective work like I do, coming to understand what are the drivers of climate change over different timescales. And we have a pretty good handle on that. Over millions of years, climate change comes about through processes like what we think of as plate tectonics. The continents, the distribution of the continents changes through time in such a way that has, global scale consequences for climate. There are natural CO2 emissions that come from volcanic activity over those long timescales, and that results in warming during times of high CO2, which, by the way, is an important lesson for the present day. Over shorter timescales, like I work on, the main natural driver of climate change is changes in the geometry of the Earth and Sun. The shape of the Earth's rotation around the Sun varies a little bit over time. The tilt of the Earth's axis towards the Sun changes a little bit over time in such a way that it affects the amount of sunlight received at different parts of the Earth's surface. We know how that varies through time, and we can factor that into our evaluation of what's been happening over the last century. At really short timescales, the kinds of things that affect climate naturally are minor natural variations in the output of the sun and volcanic eruptions. When you have big volcanic eruptions, the most recent good example of this is Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991. There's a bunch of material that ends up in the atmosphere that has the effect of reflecting off incoming solar radiation and results in cooling for a year or two. So we have a good handle on all of this. We know over different timescales what causes climate to change. And that allows you to look at the past century and say, okay, which of these things have been changing in a way that would affect climate? And you can actually do this quantitatively using climate models. put in these natural components of the Earth system, run the model, and see if the planet gets warmer. By the way, it doesn't. Then you run the model again, including human-caused or human aspects of environmental change, including greenhouse gases. You run the model, and that produces the warming that's actually taking place. So I find that a really compelling exercise because it sort of puts on the table the different factors that cause climate to change, including the natural ones and the human ones. And you basically see what causes the planet to get warmer. And the bottom line is you can't reproduce the warming that's taken place unless you put a bunch of CO2 into the atmosphere.
that's the basic bottom line. Extinction Rebellion focuses on action. And what do you see as the implications of your research for action? And how does this information help us to do the kinds of things we need to get done because we are in crisis?
Sure. There are a few things that I hope come away from this kind of retrospective science for thinking about the way that for thinking about ecosystems. Looking to the past is useful for a couple of reasons. One is identifying targets for ecological restoration. So human impacts have been on the planet have been huge, and many scientists and conservationists and conservation organizations are interested in trying to restore natural function to ecosystems. We can look using these kinds of records to past centuries prior to European colonization, for example, and get a sense of what species were there, what sort of processes were operating, and what were the roles of indigenous people in interacting with ecosystems in different parts of the planet.
That was the subject of one of your research papers, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Another sort of action that comes away from thinking about this kind of scientific research is this question of whether species are going to be able to keep up with their optimal climate. It seems as if species have managed to respond to climate in the past, but given the rapid climate changes that we're anticipating for the rest of the century, they may not be able to keep up. And this is causing some scientists and some conservationists to consider an approach that's sometimes referred to as assisted migration. And the idea would be to actually intervene in a way, take species that are struggling or declining in populations because of the consequences of global warming where they currently live, and actually moving them, picking up their seeds and planting those seeds in areas to the north or at higher elevations where their optimal climate already is or soon will be. I would say that is somewhat controversial in that some people would consider assisted migration to be another form of sort of encouraging invasive species. And, I think it's an interesting discussion to have. Especially if you're concerned about biodiversity and concerned about the literal extinction of some species because of global warming. One last thing that I think is useful in terms of action is looking to the past gives us a sense of the consequences of our actions and the consequences of either hitting or missing different temperature thresholds. So, the Paris Agreement, for example, sets a temperature threshold of 2 degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial levels as mm-hmm. as sort of a high-end goal, and suggests that we should endeavor to hit as much as possible just a degree and a half of warming. We can look to the past for insights into whether that half a degree matters, or worse yet, if we miss those targets and end up with 4 or 5 degrees of Celsius warming, what does that look like in terms of disruption of ecosystems, in mm-hmm. terms of sea level rise? Those are insights that we can get from looking to times in the past when climate has been warmer than it is right now, and those changes have been in play.
Excellent. Now, I'm going to ask one other question, and that is thinking about activists. How would you soundbite your research so that we can put it on a poster? That's kind of tough, I know.
Yeah. you know, what you take away from climate science broadly is a message of sort of dire consequences, which is that if we don't get serious about mitigation, we start to meddle with the Earth system in ways that are hugely problematic for human societies. That's a message that the general public should take away, and that's a message that policymakers should take away. That is crystal clear from the science.
Sort of like climate mitigation or death.
Literally, I mean, for many places around the world, there are clear human health consequences.
Yes.
Associated with climate change, and this is especially the case in the global south. This is especially the case in low income and communities of color in industrialized countries. And that needs to be clear, which is that this is not a problem that is generations away, and this is not a problem that is experienced in far flung parts of the planet. Climate change is going to affect all of us during our lifetimes, and in some ways that's truly problematic.
You are listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And we are here today with Wyatt Oswald, professor at Emerson College. And he is a climate scientist explaining to us some of his research and findings and perspectives on long-term climate change, thousands of years of ecosystemic data. We haven't actually gotten into too much of your findings. I mean, when you cut into the mud and you core into the ice, what do you find? You've mentioned that there was this period, maybe a long time ago, I don't know how long ago, when the world was warmer than it is now. So what was that all about, and how did it get to its relatively cool state?
Sure. So, there are a number of different intervals of warmth or relative warmth at different times in Earth's history. The most recent time when globally climate was warmer than it is today was about 120,000 years ago. And this would have been prior to the last ice age. So the last 2 million years of Earth history has been punctuated by ice ages. So with a regular sort of rhythm of about 100,000 years, we go in and out of ice ages, and then periods of relative warmth like we're in now, which scientists refer to as interglacial. So these are like glacial, interglacial cycles. So those, as I said before, are controlled by changes in the geometry of the Earth and Sun. And no two ice ages are the same. That is, some ice ages are colder than others with more extensive glaciations. And no two interglacials are the same. So the last interglacial, just given the nature of the geometry in the Earth and Sun at that point in time, was warmer than this one should be. The temperature maximum for the present interglacial was about 9,000 years ago. So in other words, it's been cooling off since 9,000 years ago up until the last 100 years. And were it not for human activities, especially emission of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we'd be on a gradual trajectory into the next ice age. But amazingly, through human activities, we have taken the planet off of this natural rhythm. We've taken it off of this trajectory of cooling, and are instead bringing about an incredibly rapid warming, at a rate of which you rarely see in sort of natural environmental change. So, lessons from the past are, let's look at those periods of warmth and let's see how high sea level was. Let's look at, periods of warmth in the past and see how far to the north or how far, up in elevation, different types of forests moved. And that gives us real insights into what the future will be like.
Professor Oswald, thank you so much for speaking with us today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio, and we will talk to you next week.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
This is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Sangre Soulful Sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio. Sweet Tuesday, darling Tuesday.
Greetings, Pacifica members. This year, the month of June brings three different election activities to the network. We urge you to vote, and you can also run as a candidate if you choose. First, the nominations period for the 2021 Local Station Board Delegate elections is now open and continues through June 30th. Second, starting on June 7th, watch for an email, postcard, or paper ballot to vote in the bylaws referendum. Be sure to vote by July 7th. Third, a proposal to amend Pacifica's Articles of Incorporation has been published for your review. For more information about all of these important choices, visit elections.pacifica.org and leave a voicemail at 510-933-0320.
Greetings, WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Interested in becoming a member of the local station board? Well, elections for the board are coming up, so come get a taste of what it might be like to serve on the WBAI local station board by attending the next meeting Wednesday, June 9th at 7 p.m. It's a Zoom access meeting. It's accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and the easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also dial in from your phone. To get those call-in numbers, just go to WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org, and we hope you can join us at the next LSB meeting, June 9th. Again, it's at 7 p.m. This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
How I wish you were here. Stand with Assange New York and the Assange Defense Committee invite you to tune in to a very special event. Julian Assange's father and brother, John and Gabriel Shipton, will be arriving from Australia to conduct a four-week-long, 18-city marathon speaking tour, Home Run for Julian. They hope to educate people about Julian's arrest, his persecution, and the legal case where the U.S. is currently requesting his extradition from the U.K. in order to face trial here for espionage. It is the first time in history a publisher has been charged under the Espionage Act, now over 100 years old. Guest speakers will be the satirist and radio host Randy Credico, journalist and television host Chris Hedges, journalist at The Gray Zone Aaron Mate, and composer, Pink Floyd co-founder, and activist Roger Waters. That's Thursday, June 10th at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI New York.
And a previous program.